Coming to you live from the planet of Mandalore, it's the Hand Plus Podcast, where each week I, Joe Bricky, and my co-host Tristan Mayer break down this week in streaming. We kind of say, hey, this is what we watch, this is what's coming out, this is the trailers, this is the news, and we just kind of talk about streaming in general. We may get a little meta talking about the streaming services themselves, who's winning, who's losing, the highs, the lows, basically anything to do with streaming. Tristan and I are here to break it down and talk about it. Tristan, how was your week in streaming?
It was a pretty solid week. We talked last week that it was kind of light, and this week it was light in parts, but I did get to fill some spots in, and I kept going on my DC watch, so I'll pick you guys up on a little bit of where I'm at on that binge when you go into HBO Max territory. But I'm definitely looking forward to the episode in general, because even though there wasn't a ton this week, there's a lot coming up, and it's going to be a very heavy on discussion this week on the episode, because you're going to be giving us a lot of recap and information that I'm going to need to know going into next week. So yeah, going to be a good episode here, and I can't wait to hear what you watched this week.
All right, same to you. I'm excited. I like a lot more, I think, when we're part of the show is us recommending stuff to each other, and it's not so much, especially the early episodes where we tried to watch the same thing, so we kind of had a point and counterpoint opinion on it. But I like it a little bit more when we have different things, and it's a little bit more about us recommending stuff to each other, because I feel like ultimately that's what the show is us recommending things to the people that watch and listen to the show. So let's kick this off and start this with some HBO Max. We got a little bit of news. We got a trailer drop, I believe today or yesterday, I don't quite remember. It's a teaser for the show Love and Death, and according to Wikipedia, the show is a series based on the true story of a Wiley, Texas housewife, Candy Montgomery, who was accused of the brutal axe murder of her friend Betty Gore in 1980. It stars Elizabeth Olsen, Jesse Plemons, and Kristen Ritter. It's written by David E. Kelley, who's written and created a lot of classic great television shows, and it's directed by Leslie Linka Glatter, and it debuts April 27th. Nothing I really knew anything about. I watched the trailer, and I was immediately intrigued. I think it's going to be a little bit shorter. I think this is just kind of like a quick mini-series produced by, I believe, the people that did Big Little Lies. Tristan, did you have time to watch this teaser?
I didn't see this teaser, but I had seen footage from this. They had some highlights from it in the coming up this year on HBO Max trailer they put out a couple of months ago. So it's on my radar, and I'm watching the trailer now as we're talking about it. And yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to this, especially with the connection to Big Little Lies. I thought that was just an incredible work. Of course, the actual director and the mind behind that passed away recently, so it won't be as direct of a connection to Big Little Lies as I would dream of it being. But I'm looking forward to it, especially Elizabeth Olsen. It'll be cool to see her get out of that Marvel kind of mud. You know, I love those Marvel movies sometimes, but it is cool to see the actors actually get out, and we'll see if she can deliver something great here. Like, could this be her Emmy performance? Could this be her, like, Amanda Seyfried moment where she gets up and runs away with some awards here? I could really see that happening, you know, because she had a good kind of indie run going for herself, and then, you know, obviously slowed down because she was getting a lot of work in franchise stuff. So I can't wait to see what they do with this.
Yeah, I mean, even in the MCU, especially WandaVision, a show I wasn't super high on, but she had a great performance in that. She had a great performance in the Jason Sudeikis, Ed Harris movie, Kodachrome. If you haven't watched that, check that out. I believe that might be a Netflix original, so I think that could be on Netflix. Really good small movie, and then also great in the Jeremy Renner movie, Wind River, which I really liked a lot.
Yeah, I don't want to downplay Jesse Plemons either. One of the better actors working today for sure. And he just does some of his best work has been on TV and on miniseries, you know, so I can't wait to see how they play off of each other. I think they're going to have a really cool vibe. You know, just seeing them as performers, you can see how they're going to mesh really well together, I think.
Yeah, I'm definitely very excited to see it. That comes out April 27th, like I said. And hey, we're coming up, you know, talking about series, talking about high-profile series with high-profile actors. We're coming up on the end of The Last of Us. We're getting towards the end of it. Tristan, what are your thoughts on this season? Is this one of the greatest, basically, television seasons of all time? Is this the next Game of Thrones, like this big hype series that everyone talks about, everyone knows about?
I'm not sure if it's the next Game of Thrones, but I could see it being the next, you know, Mad Men, you know, a really acclaimed series. It maybe isn't capturing the massive, huge, popular zeitgeist of the world, but I think it's going to have the critical acclaim, especially knowing that at this point, you can tell by the time they finish this first season, they're going to have finished the plot of the game. And you imagine one or two seasons of part two, and then they're kind of done with it. I think that's going to help it For sure. But yeah, this has been a great adaptation so far. It's done a great job of balancing changes and balancing, you know, literal shot for shot, line for line moments from the game. It doesn't feel obligated to do either one, which I think is a great balance. And we ended on kind of a fake out cliffhanger, I would say, last week. And I think this show has once in a while dropped into the schlocky TV territory a couple of times. And I'm curious to see how it all comes together. The ending of The Last of Us is a very divisive moment. And that's something that a lot of people walk away with very different feelings on, how they feel about the characters and their actions. I know friends who had totally different readings of the exact same ending of that game. So I'm really, really curious how they're going to adapt the final arc here into the TV version. How are they going to show the violence? How are they going to show some of the ways that characters, you know, the stories end and the choices that are made? I can't wait to see how it goes. But so far, it's been a great adaptation. Really, really strong. Great delivery of the story. I'm seeing a lot of people who are not familiar with the game that are still liking this, you know, because I was nervous going in. Does this only appeal to people who like The Last of Us and already know this plot and want to see it play out? But I know people who maybe knew what the game was, but or something like that, but are still enjoying this, you know. So I'm curious, Joe, if you ever do get to it as somebody who has virtually no familiarity with the game at all, how you'd feel about it. Whether you get to it by the end of the season or not, I definitely want to get your thoughts, because I'm loving this so far. It's doing a great job of being post-apocalyptic and zombie without being tropey on those genres at all. It doesn't feel like you're watching The Walking Dead ripoffs, or you're watching, you know, World War Z ripoffs or anything like that. It feels like it's taking elements of things we've done before, but not repeating itself at all. So I'm loving this so far. I can't wait to see how it wraps it up, because these last couple episodes, especially this next one coming up, Left Behind, is going to be based off of a very specific part of the game, I can imagine. This could definitely cement it as one of the greatest TV seasons of all time, or it could kind of drop the ball here and be one of those almost was seasons, yeah. You know, because they're very much at a turning point right now, where I think that'll define how we look at the show as a whole.
Yeah, I can understand. I think I'm at the point, like, originally my plan, I was going to watch week to week with everybody else, but then I kind of started to fall behind and I'm like, okay, I'll catch up by the season finale. But now I'm kind of at the point where, like, I'll wait for the season finale to come out. If the season finale comes out strong and everyone loves it, I'm definitely going to probably hop on and immediately watch the series. But if that season finale comes off and everyone's like, the show started off strong and it had some great episodes, but the ending was kind of weak, and then people are even unsure of what season two is going to be because it kind of just told the story of season one, I may just never get to it, because I'm like, is it going to be worth it at that point?
Yeah, I'll definitely let you know if it's worth it. So far, it's worth the journey, but I think the destination, especially when you're talking about this, is like a beginning, middle, and end story. You know, you want the ending to deliver, so that's going to really cement this. The highs and the lows have been there so far, but the ending is going to be what you remember, you know?
Yeah, definitely. All right, you told us at the top of the show that you had watched some DC animated projects on HBO Max. What have you been watching? Anything you'd recommend to people who aren't fully kept up on the DC animated side of things?
I'm kind of trying to make myself an order here, you know. So this time I watched adaptations of some of the biggest Batman arcs of all time. I started off with Year One. A few years ago that came out. It was an adaptation of Batman's origin story, the comic book that inspired, you know, Batman Begins. But it's essentially become the origin story of Batman, right? So this animated version of that adapts that story pretty specifically, you know, like essentially scene for scene. It doesn't do any of, once in a while DC does some crazy huge like swing of changes to the plot of an adaptation where you're like, okay, I guess that's what you're going for. This doesn't do anything crazy like that. Like, there's some moments that aren't the same, obviously. They're going to add depth to the characters, they're going to change things around, but it's a pretty strong adaptation of that book. I've read the book a few times, and of course the comic is going to entrance me a little bit more. The animation, the detail on the art is going to be a little bit greater, the style is going to be a little bit greater, but I think if you're someone who wants to get these story arcs and you don't want to sit there and necessarily read a comic that's going to take you a long time or a few days to get through, you can watch this and get through the whole thing in, like, you know, less than 90 minutes, and you'll have the entire Year One story given to you. So I think it's definitely worth a watch if you're someone who has not read this book. But if you're somebody who has, it's a good adaptation, but it kind of feels like, you know, I've read this. I know I've seen this done better, you know, but it's a strong adaptation of a really, really, really great graphic novel. Have you seen this version, or have you read Year One, Joe?
I own Year One. I've read Year One. I watched it. I agree with everything you said. It's a solid adaptation. It's definitely not the best of the animated Batman works, but it's still a good adaptation and a good story. And I think if you're a big Batman fan, worth checking out.
I moved on from that to another adaptation, The Long Halloween. They decided to split The Long Halloween. It's a longer book than Year One, but Long Halloween takes place in Year Two, essentially. It's Batman over the course of a year hunting down a killer called Holiday, who's been hunting off people on holidays and essentially like staging murders based off of, you know, the day of the year that it is. And Batman is trying to hunt this guy down in time. And every time, you know, a holiday starts coming around, you check out on Batman again, and he's kind of like tense. He's ready for something to strike again. And I think it captures the change from Year One to Year Two really well. You know, Gotham is totally different. Year One is it's a very much a crime thriller. It's very much focused on the mob and the crime side of it. And Long Halloween brings in the supervillain side, brings in kind of the real comic book crazier side. And you kind of get the sense that like the events of Year One kind of opened up the Pandora's box of Gotham City, you know, and now it's being flooded by all these villains, you know. So if you're a fan of the classic Batman villains, you get all, you know, the highlights. Some of his biggest and hardest hitters are in here. So I think if you're new to Batman, new to Batman animation especially, I think this is a great place to start, because you're going to see a bunch of familiar characters. You're going to, you know, see a story you may have been familiar with, because it was used to adapt into The Dark Knight and a couple of the bigger Batman stories since. But I think this is actually an even better starting point than Year One, because Year One, sure, it's a great origin story, but at this point, you know the origin story of Batman pretty well. If whether you've seen Batman Begins, you kind of know how this goes. I would recommend jumping in on Long Halloween. It's I think the two-part structure really works, because you're able to kind of build out this mystery and build out this story. I still prefer the graphic novel over this, but I think this is a stronger adaptation. It makes some bigger changes, while also kind of, I think, really maintaining that core and showing you all the highlights and the high lows of Gotham City and, you know, the beginning of Batman as we know him.
Yeah, definitely the story is good. I don't even remember if I've watched the animated movie or not, but I know the story from the comic very well, and it's a good story. Definitely, I agree with what you say. If you have a somewhat familiarity with the character, but not a deep dive knowledge, I think that animated movie would be a good place to start.
Yeah, definitely recommend all of those. I watched some live action DC movies, but I think I'm going to save them for something else that I'm going to do on the channel here. So check out our YouTube or somewhere else on the feed. I'm probably going to be dropping some DC stuff coming up next month in March. So watch out for that.
All right. A movie I would add to your watch list, if you don't have it already, if you want maybe some Elseworlds stuff, something a little bit different, I'd definitely check out on HBO Max the movie Gotham by Gaslight, which was adapted from an Elseworlds comic, which is essentially Batman in Victorian London hunting down Jack the Ripper.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to getting into some of the Elseworlds stuff. You know, I have a couple of the mainstays like Dark Knight Returns coming up, but once I wrap up stuff like that, I'm going to be getting into some of the weirder stuff, you know, that I haven't got a chance to get through. So I can't wait to get to it.
All right. And one of the things I wanted to talk about, I was going to talk about it when we talked about the Love and Death trailer, but I forgot about it. And so I'll talk about it now. I noticed, it's not that big of a deal, but I noticed when the Love and Death trailer popped up, it just said a Max original. It didn't say an HBO Max original. Mm. So do you think HBO Max and HBO is building towards maybe like a small rebrand to differentiate and separate HBO and HBO Max?
I think that would be a good idea, because once they announced HBO Max, there's been confusion since that day of what is HBO Max, what is HBO Now, what is HBO, what am I getting, what am I paying for? And especially if I think there might be a future where like the HBO Now price separates from the HBO price, you know, maybe we can start seeing the subscription for Now become a different subscription than the HBO the channel. I'm curious to see how they do this brand going forward, you know, because I think that would be an interesting choice for them, for sure. To remove the HBO brand would be interesting. HBO comes with a lot of prestige, you know. So does Max come with any prestige?
No, that just sounds like, you know, guy. Max. Yeah, this guy, a guy named Max filmed this show in his garage, you know. That's
what it for some like. Reason, the name Max just sounds like you're signing up for some kind of X-rated platform, you know.
Yeah.
You're paying for some more adult content, you know, than HBO is providing.
Yeah, that's what I remember when YouTube Red was a thing. YouTube Red, that part of the reason YouTube Red folded is because, based on market research and everything, everyone thought it just sounded like an adult thing, because, you know, you have red brand trailers and all that. So YouTube Red just sounded like an adult platform, I guess.
That's probably the biggest reason it failed, you know.
Yeah. All right, you ready to hop from HBO Max over to Amazon?
I'm ready. What do we got on Prime, Joe?
All right, we got the Oscar-nominated film The Whale, starring Brendan Fraser. It's going to be streaming February 21st, which is today. So, hey, you can go stream The Whale currently on Amazon Prime. So, yeah, Brendan Fraser, pretty decent chance he wins the Oscars. So if you want to be a little bit prepared for the Oscars, want to make sure you watch some of the bigger movies that are going to win some of the bigger awards, definitely check out The Whale on Amazon Prime. Tristan, have you seen The Whale?
I have seen The Whale. I enjoyed it a lot. I've heard a lot of mixed things. I know people came out of it and hated it and thought it was very exploitative and kind of, you know, fat phobic. And I think how you feel about this movie will entirely depend on how you feel about that question. You know, like, how do you feel about how this movie portrays this character? Is it empathetic or is it kind of with disgust? And I think that is going to be how you feel about this movie. I like it a lot. I think it's very emotionally moving. You see this man struggling to improve his life and having all, you know, it's like the option to improve is right there. He can go to the doctor. He can get the surgery done. He has, you know, the availability to do that, but he's making a choice not to do that. And that can be very, very frustrating to watch, but I think it can also represent the fact that a lot of our own self-destructive habits, the cure to that is well within our reach if we really wanted to do it, you know, but we're choosing not to do it. And what does that say about ourselves? And what does that say about the people around us? And I think if you look at this movie more as a metaphor for toxic behavior in general, I think it works really well. But if you're looking at it as a movie about someone who eats too much, I think it can feel a little bit offensive, you know, with a fat suit and all. But I liked it a lot, you know, and I think if you can apply yourself to this character, you're really, really going to feel this experience. And I think it's definitely worth the watch.
All right, yeah. I definitely want to check it out. I'm going to try my best to check it out. I know you also watched the movie Beast on Amazon Prime. I believe that is the Idris Elba action movie.
Yeah, I did watch this. Not nearly as emotionally complex, I would say, as The Whale, but this is still, you know, just as great. I'm hoping this gets, you know, sneaks in for the Best Picture nomination. You know, they're going to come out and be like, wait a second, we wrote the name wrong. It's actually Beast, you know, for 2022's Best Picture. But I don't see that happening. Beast, it stars Idris Elba, who is, you know, of course, a great actor and I think a perfect fit for this type of movie. It's him and his two daughters who get out, they're kind of like out on a safari with him and his old friend, and they get lost out there and attacked. They're now being, you know, attacked, and they have to learn to survive and fight. It's, you know, just a fun, cool action movie. I think if you're looking for anything beyond, you know, what this is going to be, it's just a lion hunting down Idris Elba and him fighting to survive for, you know, just about 2 hours. I think it has that emotional core of, oh, it's his daughters, he's fighting to save his family. So if you can attach to that, you're going to have a great time with this. I had a really good time with this. It's a blast. You know, if you're trying to watch something that's just going to be a fun kind of adventure, I liked it a lot, especially in an era where everything is like a sequel or a reboot of some other thing, just to see a movie called Beast where it's a action star and he's fighting a lion and that's all you got. You know, I think that it's kind of fun to watch one of those once in a while and have some dumb popcorn fun. I think it's just a lot of fun and one you can watch with just about anybody. You know, The Whale, I think you got to have a very like specific audience and like a specific mindset to get in that movie. You can just throw this on, grab a couple of beers, you and your friends can sit around and watch this and have a good time. I definitely recommend checking this one out, even as like a palate cleanser in the award season, you know.
So what you're saying is Idris Elba watched The Gray and he was like, I want to make that movie but with a lion instead of a wolf.
He did, and he was like, what if it was like action oriented, you know? What if it was, instead of really depressing and nihilistic, what if it was just like cool, you know?
Yeah, I get that. What if we just took the last scene from The Gray and made that the whole movie and took out the wolf and put in a lion?
Yeah, that's more what it was like.
All right. And another movie I know you checked out is somebody that I used to know. Came out this year. I think it was direct to Amazon Prime, starring Dave Franco and his wife, Alison Brie, who people know from Community.
Yeah, I didn't realize that. I know that she was in it, but as you start the credits and stuff, you realize she actually co-wrote the movie with Dave Franco. So it was, you know, a nice couples project there, you know, and Dave Franco got to direct it, and it was pretty interesting. It follows Alison Brie, who's returning back to her hometown and reuniting with her ex. They have this kind of like together where they start thinking like, hey, you know, what would have happened if we really stayed together and didn't break up and he didn't leave and that kind of a thing. And she kind of starts to think, maybe he's right, maybe I should have. And then you realize the next morning that he's actually recently married. He has a whole new wife and a whole life together. And you start to follow this relationship. And from that premise, you think you know where this is going to go, right? You think, oh, the wife's going to be terrible. You know, she's going to realize that, you know, she's not right for him and I'm right for him and we're going to get back together. And it's not quite like that. It's much more complex and compelling. All of the characters in the relationships are, you know, as you think you start knowing where it's going to go, they kind of bring a new aspect into it. And you start to realize that she's getting involved with both of these people more so than just the husband. And she's kind of these intertwining relationships. And you mentioned community. There's a fun community crossover here with Danny Putty, who has a small role, but you get to see him and Allison Brie reunite on screen for a little bit, which is always fun. And the cast is honestly pretty stacked. You have Haley Joel Osment and some small roles. It's one of those indie movies where you'll see someone pop up for a couple of scenes and you're like, oh, okay, they're in this movie for a few scenes. And it's a nice drama with some compelling like character mystery of like, how did he meet this woman? What's really going on in these relationships? Who's kind of playing who? It doesn't really reach for anything new or interesting or exciting beyond just being a pretty solid character drama, you know? But I'd recommend it if you're an Allison Brie fan for sure, because you get to see her really stretch in some dramatic range here and there and get, you know, a little sexy here and there, and you get to see a really an Allison Brie-centered movie. But as far as Dave Franco's directing, this is not a super exciting entry in his lineup, so it doesn't get me, like, hyped for whatever he does next, you know? I'll probably... Whatever he does next, I'm hoping is a little bit more interesting and more kind of genre than this.
All right. Awesome. You ready to hop over to Netflix?
I'm ready. Where are we going, Joe?
All right, Netflix. So a little bit of news first. They have quietly dropped their Surprise Me Shuffle button. I've used it a couple times, and every time I went through like 20 things, and I never found anything that it made me want to watch. So I just went back and found something myself. So I'm not really surprised. Tristan, you ever use the Surprise Me button?
Yeah, I was in a similar boat to you. I tried it a bunch of times, and I ended up spending, you know, like half an hour skipping through the first 2 minutes of very certain things I never ended up wanting to watch. You know, here and there, I think it did find me like a movie I ended up getting through or something, but definitely a feature that on the face of it seems good, but their algorithm of random I didn't necessarily trust. I feel like I was getting Netflix originals like, you know, 95% of a shuffle time, and I'm like, that can't be right, you know? Mm. What are the odds of you giving me the newest drop from Netflix? Oh, what a random coincidence that is, you know?
Yeah.
I would have liked it more if maybe they shuffled through your list, you know, instead of just everything. Maybe it just goes through like the stuff you already chosen to have wanting to watch, you know, because
yeah.
I was getting a lot of trash and a lot of stuff that I just, why was this recommended to me, you know?
Yeah, it'd be nice if like their algorithm included like your want to watch viewing, shows you've watched over and over and over again, and then maybe like some movies that you watched two or three times, but it's been a while since the last time you watched them. I feel like that would be a better algorithm rather than completely random, as in so far to say the stuff we would like you to watch so we can say that you watched it.
Yeah, the biggest frustration with Netflix is they have so much stuff, but it's very hard to find a lot of the stuff that they have, because what they give you on your homepage is like such a select amount of stuff that is curated off of this like generated number of Netflix users or something. It's like very impersonal, and I wish there was a better way, because I look at something like HBO Max and you could at least go through really deep dives into like, oh, they're DC hub, they're Looney Tunes hub, they're this and that hub, and you can go through movies A to Z, and Netflix, all you got are like the categories they give you, you know?
Yep. Yeah, I get that. It makes sense. We also have some sad news. Arrested Development is leaving Netflix. I'll be honest, I've never seen an episode of Arrested Development. Doesn't really affect me, but I know it's kind of a cult classic type show that's kind of on that verge of cult classic just to genuine classic show. A pretty large vocal fandom, so I'm sure a lot of people will be unhappy about its leaving Netflix.
Yeah, I'm definitely one of those people. This is a show that I watch all the time. Like, I've seen this whole show through like multiple times on end. And Netflix is a perfect house for it. Of course, they'd made their own couple of seasons, and how you feel about those might be a little bit mixed. You know, I really like season 4, but that's not a popular opinion. And season 5 was just pretty much roundly hated by everyone who watched it. So Netflix kind of took the show on. It was one of the first shows they ever did that to, where they said, oh, this is this long dead show, we're going to revive it. It was one of the first times that had ever really happened in the streaming era, you know? So it was kind of a big moment of history for that, you know? And I think the original show for me is a part of streaming history too, because it was one of the first shows I remember just binge watching hard on Netflix, you know, back when I first signed up for streaming on Netflix. And I was like, here's a show I've kind of heard it about, you know, I know Michael Cera, I know a couple of these actors, I'm just gonna watch it. And then you get yourself hooked, and all of a sudden you've watched all the seasons in, you know, 2 days or whatever. And that was something that I remember, that show being like, oh wow, streaming is something here to stay, something cool. That's like, really, I would have never watched this show if it wasn't for streaming, you know? And it's kind of sad because now I'm never going to watch the show because of streaming. You know, there's going to be two seasons of the show that are gone from history forever because Netflix, I don't imagine. See, I think they put out like one or the two of the seasons they made, but they don't really release movies like that, you know? So, damn, it's going to suck to have that show be gone. I wonder if it ends up somewhere else because that's, like you said, it has a big following. So I'm imagining that some other platform is going to buy it up somewhere, you know? But what does that mean for season 4 and 5? I don't know.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. And also we have David Fincher has come out and said that Mindhunter season 3 is never going to happen. Basically, he said the show was too expensive to make and it didn't get the viewership to basically make sense for season 3 to come out.
Yes, another depressing day for Netflix news, I feel like, Joe. And it's sad because I watched the first season of Mindhunter and I never watched the second. And it was in my mind, I was waiting because I was going to watch it when season 3 was finally announced, you know, because I was like, oh, then I'm going to finally binge through season 2. And now it's like Netflix decided not to renew it, not to continue it, pursuing it. And now it's like they cost themselves a potential viewer, maybe potential a lot of viewers who would have watched it once it dropped again. And it makes me wonder where Netflix's priorities are. You know, they seem to be all about the user base, all about the views, all about the numbers. And something like Mindhunter could have gotten them a huge amount of prestige, which is something Netflix, I think, is lacking right now. And like, you know, they can talk about only one platform has won the best picture at the Oscars, and it's the platform that sure doesn't have the drops constantly all the time, but I feel like they put themselves on the map because they pursued a couple of really, really high quality projects, and Netflix seems to be going the opposite direction. You know, let's just get the mass produced anything that will consume people's eyeballs for as cheap as possible.
Yeah, I was listening to the Force Center podcast today. It's a Star Wars focused podcast, but they were talking about the news of like Disney having layoffs and all that, and we might get to some of that when we talk Disney Plus, but I thought, and his, one of the people on the podcast, Joseph Scrimshaw, his point was basically like the numbers and the data and everything related to streaming for the last, basically since the dawn of streaming until about now, was, you know, subscriber acquisition. Like, did this show get us subscribers? But you reach a point with certain things, like especially Netflix and Hulu and Amazon Prime, and now we're kind of at that point with Disney Plus and probably soon to be HBO Max, you've reached your subscriber limit. Like, anyone that's ever going to subscribe to you is going to subscribe to you. I feel like everyone in America, whether they use somebody else's account or their own, has access to Netflix. So, like, I don't know what they're going to do as far as how do you gauge whether to keep a show or get rid of a show when it comes to, because none of them are going to, your next big show isn't really going to get you any more subscribers if you're Netflix, but also everyone's going to have Netflix regardless if you make this show or not. So it's like you're at a point where you're just like, we have to make just enough, or, you know, release just enough to retain our subscriber base and not really lose our subscribers.
Yeah, it's an interesting time because the bubble of streaming seems to be at this popping point a little bit where everyone was pouring, you know, billions and billions of dollars into the streaming industry. And now it's like, oh, maybe that's not profitable to just pour money in with no plan on how it's going to come back to us, you know? So I understand Netflix and people like Warner Media, they want to make their money back and they're, you know, they need to make money. In the end, they're only a company. But yeah, I think that it's going to show in the long run, you know, like sure, these numbers are going to get them through for the next couple of years with their subs or whatever, but you know, in 5-10 years, are they going to still be around? Are they just going to be like, you know, the whatever cable platform that sure is still there getting the user base, but is it even anything that people are talking about at all, you know?
Yeah. All right. Yeah, that's another big thing of just like, I think the ones that are going to subscribe are your HBO Maxes and Disney Plus that have a big library to fall back on, and they don't have to spend money acquiring other things to have on their platform. All of their money is spent on creating new content, and they don't really have to worry about buying and acquiring content. I think, honestly, that's what a lot of the Fox acquisition for Disney was like, we basically want Fox's library to put on Disney Plus and Hulu.
Yeah, it was, we want your characters, we want your IP, and we want your backlog. You know, that's exactly what we want. We want to be able to release your movies on Blu-ray. We want to be able to syndicate your movies out to TNT. You know, that's a lot of money that we don't really think about in the studio side, but it's much more than the movies you put out in theaters. You know, there's such a huge industry to it.
Yeah, and Netflix, I mean, they have older shows, but they're not putting them on Netflix anymore. They're taking them off Netflix. So, like, what library does Netflix truly have?
Yeah, I'm definitely curious. With all this stuff getting deleted, it's not the first time we've seen these headlines, so.
Yeah. All right, let's move over to stuff we've actually watched. I watched the reality show Perfect Match. I'm going to assume most people probably don't know what that is. And that's essentially the all-star crew of the Netflix reality dating shows. You know, people, and not even just the dating reality shows, all the reality shows. They have people from The Circle, people from Too Hot to Handle, people from Selling Tampa, people from The Mole. And essentially all these people come in and they're in this little villa and they're forming their own couples and they have challenges. And if you win a challenge, you and your partner, you go into this little room and they're like, hey, here's four guys that could potentially come in. You have to pick two of them and put them on dates with somebody else in the villa. And so there's a little bit of strategy if you're trying to break up couples. Maybe you're sneakily trying to bring someone in for yourself because you plan on ditching your partner for them. And then anyone who's left single at the end of the night because their partner abandoned them or they weren't picked is sent packing, and then more people are brought in the next episode. And so it's kind of, it's a little bit of strategy, a little bit drama, a little bit romance. And at the end, a couple is voted as the best couple and they will win the prize at the end. So if you like a lot of these dating shows like Love is Blind and all of that, I don't even know necessarily if you need to watch a lot of the Netflix shows and understand who these people are, but if you like, you know, your Love Islands or Bachelor in Paradise, it's somewhat very similar setup to that. So I definitely check it out if you're into those shows.
Yeah, I on Netflix this week watched The Woman King. Okay. Viola Davis is my Woman King. But I watched this movie. It got some Oscar buzz and then didn't get much love at all. And people were talking about it as a snub. Was this worthy of Oscar nominations? And I think it was definitely worthy of some attention. If you don't know the plot of this, it's set in kind of ancient Africa in the 17th century, and it follows Viola Davis, who's leading this essentially all women group of warriors who are trying to fight to defend their African kingdom. And you get great cinematography, just gorgeous, gorgeous action. And I feel like we talk about Top Gun Maverick and Avatar and how great those movies looked and how cool the action was. And I feel like this movie doesn't get talked about in that same vein. Of course, I'm not going to say it's as good as Top Gun Maverick's action or as Avatar's visual effects, but I think it's on the level that it should have been talked about as one of the better action movies of last year. And I think especially just the setting of it is so unique. How often do you see like ancient Africa in a movie at all, let alone in an action epic like this, that really shows like the length of these kingdoms and kind of, you know, the complexity of these civilizations? We think, and especially in our country in the United States, we tend to see African history as like, oh, people who are like living in huts and that kind of a thing, and there's a lot of racist history to that. And I think this, even though it doesn't show history 100% accurately, I'll talk about that, but I think it's good to show that Africa at this time was not just, you know, barren desert wasteland. There was actually a whole civilization of complex people and a whole history there that has been erased to time. And this brings that history to life in a really, really exciting and fun way. I think if you're a fan of Wonder Woman, I could imagine that these historical figures were a direct inspiration to the Amazonians who Wonder Woman hails from. So this definitely feels like, you know, what we could be getting out of something like Paradise Lost in a few years, of what, you know, Wonder Woman action movie brought to life could kind of look like. John Boyega is also great in this. I'm happy to see him doing some more stuff after Star Wars. I was scared that would kind of kill his career, but he's great in this. He looks great in this. He has a great, you know, performance and a cool accent and all that stuff. He's great in this movie, and the action I think is fantastic. Viola Davis is great. Is she a Best Actress nominee? I'm not sure she's as good as the top four in the list, but I could see her breaking in. You know, it wouldn't have been a huge shock if she did, because she's that good. And sure, she's not giving them the like biggest challenging role where she's having all these huge Oscar clips or anything like that, but for the movie that she's in, she's servicing it really, really well. She's great in this role, and you wouldn't necessarily think of Viola Davis as like an action star, you know, like she's in Suicide Squad and stuff, but she's not out there like doing the fighting and stuff like that. But she actually does action in this movie and looks awesome doing it, you know. So I highly, highly recommend it. Of course, there's some historical inaccuracies with how they portray slavery and how they portray that whole industry at that time and in that setting. And they kind of, they definitely do, they have it in the movie, but it's definitely not, it's not, it's portrayed in a way that is not accurate to the reality. Like Viola Davis is kind of conflicted with this morally, and she's kind of trying to end this trade. And that's not, from what I've been seeing, accurate at all to what was really happening at the time.
Yeah, from what I read, when the movie came out, it was kind of the opposite, where her tribe and her, as the person in charge, was fighting to keep the slave trade going. But I know my fiance and her mom watched this in theaters when it came out, and they both liked it a lot. So I've only really heard positive things from the people that have watched it.
Yeah, I definitely highly, highly recommend it. And sure, it's not super accurate to that particular part of history, but that's not what the movie is necessarily trying to be about or trying to say. And I think what it is trying to be about and trying to say really works and really hits. And I definitely think it's a great watch. And I'm glad it's on Netflix. You know, check it out and watch it. Give Netflix that view. We just talked about how bad they are, but I'll go on Netflix and watch this movie.
All right. Another thing I watched this week on Netflix was a documentary series. I only watched the first two episodes, but it's called Full Swing. And it's basically a documentary series that followed this last season of golf. And it kind of, it's not really like a full story, like an arc. Basically what I'm getting the vibe is each episode is telling kind of a different story of that season. The first episode is kind of this one guy's like comeback win in a major championship tournament. And each of the episodes, I feel like, is going to tell like kind of a different story within that season. You also have the Saudi Arabian government and the Saudis have started their own golf league, and they're just paying top players and known players like absurd amounts of money to come play golf in their new league. And there's kind of the morality of that, of like, okay, you're making all this money, but like, where did this money truly come from? And kind of that moral dilemma. But this is like the type of money that you, your kids, and their kids will never really have to worry about money. And I'll be honest, I don't give a crap about golf. I have never once purposefully turned golf on in my life. And I really enjoyed this series. I think if you're a fan of documentaries, if you're a fan of sports in general, or you're just a fan of like well-told stories, I definitely check out Full Swing on Netflix.
Yeah, it definitely made me more excited to hear you talk about it, because I saw that and I said, I don't care about golf. I'm not going to watch it, but maybe now I will.
All right. Yeah, it's worth checking out. And like I said, with each episode being a different story, you can kind of just check in here and there. You don't really need to like be like, okay, I need to binge watch this whole 8-episode thing or else I'm going to forget. You can kind of like, oh, like each weekend I'll watch an episode or something.
Hmm.
All right, you ready? Hop over to Disney Plus.
Yeah, are we going to say Disney Plus to the end for the whole discussion, or are we going to just do it now?
We only got like two other small things to talk about, so we can do that and then we'll hop over to Disney Plus.
Yeah, that makes sense, I think.
All right, so Peacock, we got Megan, the unrated version, is releasing February 24th. That was a very kind of surprise hit, I would say, for Blumhouse. It's a horror movie about a doll who comes to life. I'll be honest, I didn't watch it. It's like basically like an AI Chucky, right? Kind of a situation.
Yeah, it's a very AI Chucky. It's very tongue-in-cheek, very aware. It's more of a satire than even a horror movie, and I enjoyed it, but my biggest complaint was that I felt like it was kind of neutered. I felt like the deaths were not nearly as brutal or as gory as they seemed like they were filmed to be. It was one of those movies that felt like it was shot to be R, and then Blumhouse decided, you know what, let's go PG-13 with it. So they had to go through, edit out the violence and make it kind of more, you know, ratings friendly so they can get that PG-13 rating. So the unrated part of this makes me really excited to go check it out. I'm looking forward to seeing how much that really changes, because that was not just my primary complaint, but it felt like what everyone was kind of talking about coming out of the movie was, this was great. This was a lot of fun. It was, the performances were surprisingly, you know, heartfelt. There's actually moments where you might get a little bit teary eyed watching this movie, Megan, you know. If you don't know, it follows a young girl whose parents die in a car accident, and she has to move in with her aunt, who's a toy worker. She works in, like, you know, a toy factory, but, you know, it's a modern day toy factory, so they're not making, you know, old, you know, toys for kids or anything like that. They're making essentially AI, and they're making, you know, toys that can walk and talk, and they're trying to compete on that landscape, you know. So she's has this prototype called Megan. It's a doll that can walk and talk to you and interact with you and be your friend and remember you. And she, you know, brings the doll home to be with the daughter so that she can kind of help raise the daughter while she's working. And that kind of goes, you know, of course, it's a horror movie, so it goes very badly pretty quickly. But you get a really fun relationship between the doll and the daughter. So I definitely recommend checking it out. She has kind of this, like, protective older sister vibe to her, you know, where she's going to do anything she can to keep the daughter safe and to keep the daughter happy, and even at the cost of anybody else around her. So definitely a fun ride, a satire, a goofy ride. You're going to laugh. You're going to have a couple of screams. And I'm hoping that the unrated cut gives it even more of the bloody gore fun, because that was what I would have loved to see. Megan go crazy and rip people apart and totally unhinge. She was just kind of unhinged, you know. She unplugged, but she didn't totally unhinge.
All right. And we also, a show I've been watching on Peacock, my fiance got me into, is the show Summer House. And it's a bunch of, like, it's a reality show, and it's a bunch of late 20-year-olds, early 30-year-old kind of young professionals who all during the summer spend each weekend at this house up in the Hamptons. And it's about their relationships with each other and the dynamics of this friend group. And it's like kind of like a young professional Jersey Shore or like a Real World. But each season is predominantly the same cast. Usually each season they kick somebody from the previous cast, usually a guy and a girl from the previous cast out, and they bring in a new guy and girl. But overall, it's usually the same squad of people. And if you're into that kind of show, I definitely check it out. It's normally on Bravo, but I believe it streams pretty much right after on Peacock.
Nice. And finally get some Peacock coverage in this week. Once in a while, we don't get to get a lot of Peacock in.
Yeah. I mean, that's why we're the hand. We cover the main four, and then we'll sprinkle in some of the others. Speaking of streaming services we don't talk about very often, there's a movie currently streaming on Paramount Plus. I haven't seen it. I believe you have. So if you want to tell people about it.
I have. I watched Babylon, Damien Chazelle's 2022 epic swing. It follows these various people living in 1920s Hollywood, right in the transition of talkies taking over and silent becoming the thing of the past. You know, if you watch Singing in the Rain, this is essentially a very similar setup to that movie, where it's following these actors in Hollywood who are at the kind of the height of their game. You know, they're the biggest of the best of the silent era. You have people like Brad Pitt who are playing like the movie stars of their time. You know, everybody loves him, everybody knows him, everyone watches his movies and falls in love with him. But when it comes to trying to talk on screen, he can't do it. He just can't hit that level that anybody else can hit, you know, and he's struggling with that. And you have Margot Robbie, who's this young woman, clearly inexperienced and doesn't have any professional credit, but she wants to break into the industry. She believes that she can, and she sees all the chaos of this industry, but she somehow wants to get in on that tornado. And can she break in? Can she make it work? And you're following characters like that who are either there in Hollywood, established, who are trying to break in. And it's all kind of spiraling around this character, Manny Torres, played by Diego Calva. And I hadn't seen him, I don't believe, in anything before this. This is what my first time seeing him in anything. But he plays this this young man who's kind of just dragged into this. He's trained like an assistant or something like that. And he goes to this big party, and Brad Pitt just kind of says, oh, why don't you come help me out? And then he's kind of all of a sudden working for Brad Pitt for a while, and he's kind of in love with Margot Robbie. So he's kind of the centerpiece of this movie, following you through this big tornado of 1920s Hollywood, and the highs and the lows and the crazy parties and then the people getting killed. You know, it follows that swing of Hollywood in a really fun way. And I thought it was a blast. I had a really good time with this. I know a lot of people who did not like this at all. I thought it was audacious and too much and just a big, you know, old Hollywood jerk off session, you know, but I thought it was a good mix where there are those moments of old Hollywood, you know, praising, but then it kind of strikes you with the reality of, okay, this is all fun and cool, but the reality of this was that it was dangerous and people were, you know, dying. People were being abused and neglected in this system too. It's not all fun and Hollywood And maybe we are better off with all of this Babylon City falling and collapsing in on itself, because maybe it really isn't worth it. Or is it? You know, it kind of leaves you with that ambitious question of, is this crazy tornado of chaos and death and destruction worth it for what we get out of it? You know, the movies we get, are they worth all of this? And it leaves it up, I believe, to the audience to decide that. And I love that about the movie. I had a great time with it. I'm sad it didn't get the Oscar love I was hoping it would get, but you know, maybe it'll have a second life on streaming. So hopefully you guys check it out and give it your time and see if you like it.
All right. Yeah, I might check it out. I might not. I haven't watched a lot of movies this year, so that's probably not the first one I'm going to get to. All right. You ready to hop over to our last streaming service of the episode, and that's Disney Plus?
I'm ready.
Been saying hop over a lot. We should
Let's hop over, Joe. It is almost Easter.
I'll hop over and come up with a new transition next week, but I won't remember that I said that, so I probably won't. All right. First off, we got Kevin Feige has said that the MCU shows are going to slow down and become a little bit more episodic, and probably only Loki Season 2 and Secret Wars are likely to be released in 2023. I think it's a good move. I think oversaturation is part of the problem with certain things. I don't know about you, but I think for the MCU to last a long time, I think the best move is to have two movies and two shows a year and balance them out, spread them out, so they're not, so you don't have any movies coming out while a show is coming out, unless potentially they connect in plot and you kind of want them and it's part of the story of them coming out at the same time because they directly affect each other. Mm-hmm. But other than that, two movies, two shows a year that don't ever come overlap at the same time.
Yeah, I think spacing it out is good, not just for keeping it straight and people actually being able to keep up with this stuff, you know, because I was talking to Ant-Man. I was talking to someone about Ant-Man Quantumania, and I was saying, well, to get the most out of this, you kind of do have to watch Loki. And to get the most out of Loki, you do have to kind of watch WandaVision. And to get the most out of WandaVision, you do have to kind of watch Age of Ultron and Civil War. And I started going back, and I'm like, what am I even saying? You have to watch a whole laundry list of movies to get to Ant-Man 3. And I think that's something that they got to get past. They got to figure out how to make an actual movie that stands alone, an actual show that stands alone, and spacing it out is going to help. I think it'll also help with the production value too, because I think a resounding complaint about some of the Marvel shows has been they don't look great. They don't necessarily deliver on, you know, the action spectacle that you'd want out of something like that, you know, and I think that could help. So shows like Hawkeye and Moon Knight, I thought, could have really benefited from a little bit more time, you know, to make the most out of their action sequences.
Yeah, I think that's what Bob Iger said very recently, too. I meant to put that in here, but I didn't. And that essentially, I think with like their Marvel and Star Wars, their strategic plan is to keep the budgets the same, like potentially per year, but make less content so that the content they do release is better. And I think that was a more talking Marvel, because Star Wars hasn't released like an abundance of content the way Marvel has, where I feel like their strategy before just felt like crank it out, crank it out, crank it out, where now the Marvel strategy is more going to be like, all right, let's slow it down, step it back, and make sure it's, you know, quality over quantity.
Yeah, I'm someone who'd rather get like five or six great knockout episodes of a show in and out, you know, something like Loki,
yeah,
than get, you know, 16 episodes, something that are okay and had their highs and lows, but I'd much rather them spend their money and make it where it counts, you know?
Yeah, I think, like I said before, I think with Marvel, the best strategy is two movies, two shows a year. And with Star Wars, I think if you have two live-action shows a year, you can have one that's in, like, the Mandoverse. And if you don't have two Mandoverse shows, you have your Andor or your Obi-Wan or something else. But I think two live-action shows a year, and then you have more of, like, your teen animated show like Bad Batch, and then one more like kiddie animated show like Young Jedi Adventures. But the number one thing I would do is make sure my shows aren't coming out on the same day. Like next week when Mandalorian Season 3 premiere and Bad Batch are going to be dropping on the same day. It makes no sense. Bad Batch should be coming out on like Fridays or something like that. Or Mandalorian should start coming out on Friday. So at least they're not the same day. But I also just wouldn't even have them coming out at the same time.
Yeah, I think when you have so much content, you're going to be overlapping. And we've seen that even on the movie side, Disney's starting to like eat its own tail a little bit. Like by the time, you know, Ant-Man is done running its box office, it's probably going to have another Disney movie come running in to try to steal up its legs, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think they're learning that lesson on both fronts right now.
Yeah, like is anyone out there actually watching Bad Batch that has no desire to watch The Mandalorian? So, like, at one point, are you, so Bad Batch right now, from now until I assume the end of the season, because I assume it'll end before The Mandalorian, you're not making money off Bad Batch, because anyone that's subscribing to watch Bad Batch would have subscribed to watch Mandalorian anyways. And
Yeah.
strategically, it just does not make sense.
It'll be nice for us too. We'll have to talk about a million shows at once. You know, give us some space to do some research, you know, give us our prep time.
All
We're gonna
right,
have some good prep time coming up though.
and we'll talk about Mandalorian a little bit more in a minute, but I'll crank out this news first. Mighty Ducks Game Changers and the John Stamos-led Hot Shots both canceled after two seasons. Did you watch either of these shows?
I don't remember. I may have thrown on John Stamos for a second when we were trying to
Ooh.
review Disney Plus, you know, but I don't. I may have sat through one, but it's telling that I don't remember.
Yes, John Stamos' show Hot Shots, where basically he took over like a girls' high school basketball team. Didn't watch that. I watched season one of Mighty Ducks Game Changers, and I watched a little bit of season two. I think I watched like the first couple episodes, but then I just dipped out. I think the problem is, I mean, season two, Emilio Estevez didn't do the show because he didn't want to have to deal with the COVID protocols. He's just like, this is too much. I'm not doing that. And so I think when Emilio Estevez isn't in your Mighty Ducks show, I think it's going to hurt the show. And I think, I mean, I get what they were trying to do, but I think they should have backed the Brinks truck up to Emilio Estevez. And I think Emilio Estevez from jump should have been the star of the show instead of some random background character who's like kind of in it.
Yeah, I definitely don't have much interest in checking out this show. I don't have any nostalgia for the Mighty Ducks movies. I don't even know if I saw those movies. I did watch though the Mighty Ducks animated TV show, you know, about some superhero ducks. You know, they live in space. They did some adventures and stuff like that. They were a duck hockey team who did like space stuff. I was into that.
It just makes me question certain like Disney strategy of like the people who are going to be excited for a Mighty Duck show are people who, I mean, I understand you aren't, but the people our age. So, and like I understand Disney's a family brand, but I would have made my Mighty Duck show something that's more geared towards people in around the age of 30, but also family oriented so kids can watch it too. But is there a 10-year-old out there that saw an announcement that Mighty Ducks Game Changers was going to be a thing, a continuation of the movies from the 90s, and got anywhere at all excited? I don't think so.
No, Disney seems to be having to re decide if they're going for nostalgia or if they're going for like their actual core family demographic audience, you know. So it's definitely the cost of it.
All right, and we do have positive news. Doogie Kame Aloha season two is dropping all episodes March 31st. That's positive and negative. Positive because we're getting more of that show. If you watched our Disney Plus review, Tristan and I were oddly high on that show. However, Disney Plus has shown that if they go on a show from a weekly release to a drop all at once, probably means we're not getting a season three.
Yep, they're just kind of dropping what they already filmed. You know, they're like, well, we kind of renewed this, and I guess they'll follow through on it. You know, we're not HBO Max. You know, we're not just going to cancel stuff that we already shot. You know, so it's great to get more of it. I'm sure we'll rave about how great it was. We'll talk about how much we love Walter, and we just talked about Disney Plus having to figure out how to balance like appealing to kids and appealing to adults, and I think this has that perfect balance. You know, because I don't even think I watched Doogie Howser a single second of the original TV show, you know,
Same.
but I loved this and I thought it was a fun show that had a lot of heart. And yeah, I definitely think people who are families can watch this, and people who are nostalgic for Doogie Howser, I imagine, could watch this. But I couldn't tell you because I don't know much about Doogie Howser. Even as an outsider, though, I had a good time.
Well, I got good news for you. If you do want to know about Doogie Howser MD coming to Disney Plus March 15th. So, if you see Doogie Kame Aloha and maybe you have kids and you're showing your kids and you're maybe you grew up with Doogie Howser and you're like, this was my favorite show when I was a kid, and now you're showing Doogie Kame Aloha to your kids and they love the show, maybe you can go back and be like, hey, this is my Doogie. This is what I grew up with.
This is a real Doogie Howser, okay? You kids don't understand Doogie, all
You don't know Doogie like I know Doogie. Hey, so I'm gonna post you a question we
right?
talked about when Doogie Kame Aloha was on when we were doing our Disney Plus show. Is Neil Patrick Harris making an appearance? as himself.
I think he's got to. Season two, you got to. He's dropping the same the show, the same week or the same month or whatever.
It's like 2 weeks before. Yeah, so if you haven't watched the show, basically Doogie Howser exists as a show in the universe of Doogie Kamehaloha. And because she's like a young doctor, the other doctor, and she's like a teen doctor, the other doctors at the hospital nicknamed her Doogie. So so I think I just want to see Neil Patrick Harris cameo as himself as a patient at the hospital. He's him and his husband took a vacation to Hawaii, got in a surfing accident, and boom, he's at the hospital.
I could see a fun reverse, maybe like our Doogie, she hits her head, you know, and she runs into Neil Patrick Harris and she's convinced it's the Doogie Howser. It's Doogie. That's him, you know, and he's just like, who's this crazy doctor? You know, this teen doctor. That's ridiculous.
Yeah. I love both options. I do.
I just got to see the line where Neil Patrick Harris is like, I would never let a kid operate on me. You know, like that's insane. Who would do that?
Yeah. All right. We have some other news. Zach Galifianakis, who people know from the Hangover trilogy. He was also in the movie Birdman, as well as a bunch of other things. My favorite work of his is Between Two Ferns.
It's so good.
Joining the Lilo and Stitch live action remake, which is going to be direct to Disney Plus from the Marcel the Shell director. Any thoughts on this? I assume there's only one character he can be playing, and that's Jumba, the alien that kind of created Stitch. I feel like that's a pretty good casting choice, but I agree somewhat with what a lot of people said, that this is a show that definitely has a lot of focuses heavily on Hawaiian culture and the Hawaiian people, and your two basically leads of Lilo and her sister, and the first casting announcement they make is just like some random white guy.
Yeah, I think it's a weird. I think Zach Galifianakis is a good pick. You know, he's changed so much physically since The Hangover. You know, he's not going to be physically in this. I don't think he's going to be doing like a mocap or a voice or something, maybe.
Yeah.
But
yeah, that's what I'm picturing, is mocapture, like a voice, you know, as Jumba.
Yeah, I definitely, I mean, I'm not exactly excited for this. I'm sure it'll be fine, but Disney's track record for live action remakes is not super great. For some reason, I do feel like this is going to be better, though. Something about the Lilo and Stitch premise, and I think it just lends itself better to a remake than some of the other movies have been, because it's not the level of iconic as Lion King, where you feel obligated to do every scene exactly the same. I imagine they're going to play more loose with it and actually be able to make some changes and add some new things and move things around a bit. You know, so I think it'll be at least a good time. You know, I'm hoping it could surprise us, maybe be the best one they've done of these remakes. So we'll see.
Yeah, of the recent ones, I mean, obviously we have like 101 Dalmatians with Glenn Close in the 90s. But of the kind of 21st century ones of this kind of modern, I feel like there are only two good ones, and ones that I would actually like be down to watch just randomly throw on. And that's Cruella, which is barely a live action remake. It's more just like an alternate telling, and The Jungle Book.
Yeah, I loved Cruella because that was what, for me, it was able to not just remake 101 Dalmatians. It was like, let's take an element of this and do something cool with it and make something new out of it. And I liked it for that.
Yeah. And we also, last bit of news for Disney Plus, we got the trailer for Chang Can Dunk. I don't know if you watched this at all. Basically, it's set in a high school. And the premise of it is this kid, Chang, who's obsessed with basketball. He loves basketball. And he bets one of the kids on the high school basketball team, because Chang's not on the basketball team, that he can dunk. And the guy was like, you can't dunk. I don't believe you can dunk. And he can't dunk. But he basically says, I bet you, I don't even remember what the bet was, but he basically bet that by the final home game that Chang will be able to dunk. And from then on, if you've seen the MTV show Made, it felt like a fictionalized version of Made, where he hires a basketball coach to teach him and train him how to dunk. It literally felt like someone watched Made and was like, let's just make a fictionalized version of that, because that's what it feels like. It's where you just watch him train to learn how to dunk. And I'm not going to lie, the trailer actually looked compelling and interesting. I'm not sitting here saying this is going to win Disney Plus an Oscar or anything, but for what I assume is going to be a 90-minute direct-to-Disney Plus movie about a kid who wants to dunk, I feel like this was the best possible version of that based purely on the trailer.
Yeah, I'm curious about it. I just read up a little bit of the history of it, and the director and the writer are the same guy. He kind of wrote this and was ready to produce it, and then COVID hit, and the movie seemed like it was not going to happen anymore. And then Disney kind of picked it up and made it happen for him. So I think that's kind of a cool story behind this. So I'm hoping that it turns out good for him.
Yeah. Yeah, it looked interesting. It looked good. Hopefully it comes out good, and we'll be reviewing it on here. And finally, ready to talk about our big topic of the night?
This is our big topic. We got a lot ahead of us, but yeah.
All right. So questions going into Mandalorian. What's up with Grogu? Last season he was picked up by Luke. Is he trained now? Where's Luke? And also, how much more will Grogu's Force abilities grow this season? Any answers to those questions in your mind, Tristan?
Look, I mean, my question going in, I wanted to play devil's advocate with that question, because it's like, if you haven't seen Book of Boba Fett, I can imagine you going and you've watched season 2 of Mando, you're popping up your popcorn, you know, you got your little baby Yoda blanket over you, you know, wrapped around you, and you hit play, you're like, oh, gee, I can't wait to see what Din Djarin is like in the world without Grogu. You know, what's this season going to be like with no Grogu in it? And then, oh, there's Grogu. He's back. And I'm sure the first episode will try to explain that, Joe, but if can you be the one to tell us what's up with Grogu? Where has he been? How's he back?
So he's training with Luke, obviously, and Din Djarin, and basically Grogu wanted to be back with his daddy. He's like, I'm bored with this Jedi stuff. I don't want to be with Luke. And he decided to select to be with Din. I read some Jon Favreau comments about it. Basically him saying like he felt like leaving Grogu would feel like a massive reset, which he thought didn't make sense for the show. And I get that. I understand that. And I'm not even totally against bringing Grogu back in Book of Boba Fett. But I would have liked it better if it felt like a lot more time had passed. Like if we felt like they hadn't seen each other or they hadn't been around each other in like 2-3 years. Like if it, and this, I mean, with it being the Star Wars universe and you're not really held to like real world anything, I feel like that would have been fine to just be like something to tell us as the audience they have been apart for a long time. But it felt like it could have been a long weekend for all we know.
I'm curious on the second part, like, is Grogu's powers, we've seen the tease of that, and he's had some time with, you know, one of the most powerful Jedi in history to train a little tiny little bit, at least. And the trailers kind of tease Grogu using some more Force stuff, maybe even teetering towards the dark side a little bit. How far do you think that goes? What do you think we see from Grogu? Is this show still about Grogu growing as a Force user? Is there going to be more about Mandalore and the lore behind that and all the big looming Star Wars kind of epicness of that?
I mean, here's my thought, and I've had this thought since midway through season one, and I'm sure you and I have talked about it. Title of the show, in my opinion, does not refer to Din Djarin. I think the title of the show, The Mandalorian, refers to Grogu, and the overall plot and arc of the show is watching Grogu become the Mandalorian. So when you say, does it about him growing in his Force powers, or is it about Mandalore? I mean, I'll get a little bit into that and, you know, talk about why the Darksaber is important in my little kind of history of Mandalore that I've prepared. And then I'll talk about like kind of what episodes of Clone Wars and Rebels and some other things for people to watch who maybe haven't watched those shows but want to know more about the history of Mandalore before The Mandalorian starts. Or maybe they have watched these shows and they're just like, wait, what episode's focused on Mandalorian? Again, it's been a few years since I've watched them. But I want to do like one final question, I guess, before we get into that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've had a lot of big appearances, big jaw-dropping moments as far as like, you know, season one finale. We had the big thing of like the baby Yoda reveal. Season two premiere had Boba Fett. Shocking reveal. Season 2 finale, we had Luke Skywalker. Like, are we going to have a big season 1, like, jaw-dropping, shocking moment?
I definitely think we will. I think, especially when you're coming off of season 2 and you've had Luke Skywalker, like, you gotta make a big swing after that. And I have a prediction for who I think it'll be. Might not, you know, it's hard to be bigger than Luke Skywalker, but I think there is a character that people have been wanting to see back, an actor that people would love to see back in Star Wars. In fact, an actor who has publicly talked a lot about how he would love to come back, and revisit his character. He said, I'm not dead. There's no way I got killed by the Empire and Anakin. You know, Mace Windu is alive. I say it myself. I think we're going to see Mace Windu. The trailer that we've seen for Mandalorian, every single trailer so far, even the TV spots, are showing that Order 66 shot. Yeah,
where'd you get this idea?
Where the doors open up, you know, and it's someone is coming in to rescue Grogu and maybe a handful of other younglings. And look, this is totally an original thought to me. There's no one else who suggested this to me at all. But I think that's going to be Mace Windu. You know, when he comes in, he's going to rescue Grogu. It's going to be a totally de-aged Samuel L. Jackson. Disney loves to do that, especially in Star Wars. So I think we're going to see a spitting image of the early 2000s bald heads, Samuel L. Jackson coming in. He's going to rescue Grogu. He's going to be all burnt up and crispy. You know, he just got electrocuted by the Empire. But he's alive. He's struggling. But he's made it. And I think maybe even Grogu will help keep him alive. You know, maybe Grogu's force ability healing. He'll force heal him. You know, that's going to be kind of Grogu's, like, entry into the force healing. I could see him healing Mace Windu, so it's not quite a cop-out. You know, it's not like, oh, he just survived falling out of a massive, huge skyscraper while being electrocuted. You know, someone with the force helped him survive. And I'll do you one further, Joe, because Star Wars Celebration is only a couple of weeks, if that, maybe even a week. Maybe even less than a month, probably, after after the beginning.
A year or two, you know?
A year or two. You know, it's less than a month. I think it's what, 2 or 3 weeks after the beginning of Mandalorian Season 3. And I think at Star Wars Celebration, we're going to have Samuel L. Jackson on stage, and they're going to reveal that he's coming back for a miniseries on Disney+, a Kenobi-style, like, event series about Mace Windu. And it's all going to be thriving off of this opening sequence of Season 3 of Mandalorian.
Sorry, I was going online to figure out when. So it's April 7th.
Look at that.
It's a little over a month. It's a little over a month.
I was close, you know.
So I have my prediction. We have Greef Karga, who I feel like, based on how heavily prominent he is in the TV spots and trailers, that he is in the first episode. And what does Greef Karga like to do? And that's complain about the New Republic. And Greef Karga, who's now raising in prominence, raising in, you know, station in life, probably feels like he can make a phone call and deal with some top-level people in the New Republic and make sure his complaints are heard by the right people and not just low-level bounty hunters. So my jaw-dropping moment is Greef Karga is going to drop a couple times that he has a meeting with someone from the New Republic later on, and then the episode's going to end with former princess, now General Leia, coming in to meet with Greef Karga.
That's a great call. I think we're gonna get Han, we're gonna get Leia some point on these Disney Plus shows, right? And I think Leia's a perfect fit. We've had her in Obi-Wan, so now bring back, you know, we've had young Leia. Now we're gonna get, you know, early Republic Leia. Yeah. I'd love to see it.
Yeah, just, you know, 5, 6, 7 years after Return of the Jedi. I think that's a good option. You ready to hear about some history in Mandalore?
Yeah, give it to me, Joe, because I'm one of those people that you mentioned earlier where, like, I've seen all of these shows, but if you ask me specifics about, like, some of the plots of these episodes, I'm not going to remember. Like, a lot of the Mandalorian lore that was being thrown around last season, I was struggling to remember. So I'm looking forward to this conversation to fill me in, because even though I've seen it all, I'm still feeling kind of new here.
All right, so for people who've only seen The Mandalorian and really are kind of confused on what a Mandalorian is, or for people that maybe skimmed some of the animated shows and don't really know, or people that just watched them and forgot, here's a little background on the history of Mandalore. So the Mandalorians were a clan-based cultural group of various species led by a common creed, language, and code, originating around 10,000 BBY, aka before the Battle of Yavin, aka when the Death Star blew up, on the planet of Mandalore in the galaxy's outer rim. Throughout their history, they cared about only two things, honor and war, and were led by a sole ruler known as the Mandalore. That's MAND APOSTROPHE ALOR. The Mandalorians launched several wars of expansion against the Republic and the Jedi, colonizing nearby worlds in their system, creating their own sector known as Mandalorian Space. However, they didn't always have bad relations with the Jedi. Tar Vizsla, a human Mandalorian, was inducted into the Jedi Order as a youngling. When Tar Vizsla became an adult, he created the Darksaber around 1050 BBY, aka 1050 years before the Death Star blew up. Tar created House Vizsla and claimed the title of Mandalore with the Darksaber. Years after Tar Vizsla's death, members of House Vizsla raided the Jedi Temple and stole the Darksaber to reunify Mandalore once more. And that started another war against the Jedi. A battle on Mandalore against the Jedi led to its surface being nothing but uninhabitable white desert, except for a few hermetically sealed cities. The Mandalorians kept to themselves for a long time, but their warrior ways led to many civil wars. Wanting the fighting to end, many Mandalorians became pacifists, which led to the rise of the pacifist house, House Krees. When the pacifist New Mandalorians defeated the martial Old Mandalorians, the Mandalorians of old were exiled to the Moon of Concordia, which basically brings us up to the Clone Wars. And kind of that storyline essentially picks up from there, where the Mandalorians have conquered Dawn and other kind of systems come to Mandalore once again to kind of establish Mandalore and bring back its old ways. And so I will throw them up on the screen here. So if you're watching on Twitch, you're watching on YouTube, or even if you're watching on Spotify, you can kind of see which episodes to watch, but I will put them in the description as well, so you don't have to like pause the episode and like write them all down or anything like that. You can just go to the description. We have the Clone Wars episodes, the Mandalore plot, which is season 2 episode 12, Voyage of Temptation, which is season 2 episode 13, and the Duchess of Mandalore, which is season 2 episode 14. And this arc kind of focuses on Death Watch, which is like an extremist Mandalorian kind of group, and they're definitely the main ones that want to bring back the old ways of Mandalore. And you also see, like I said, House Krees heavily featured in these episodes as well. And it's also,
you also get to explore a lot of Obi-Wan Kenobi's history too. So if you're a fan of the Obi-Wan show, you get to definitely dive into that character. Some of the best Obi-Wan character work that's been in Star Wars is in this arc right here, or in these handful of arcs.
Yeah. And explains Clan Vizsla a little bit, and it's also the very first appearance of the Darksaber. We also have the Clone Wars episodes Corruption, Season 3, Episode 5, and The Academy, Season 3, Episode 6. These shows kind of focus on the different beliefs of the Mandalorians and also talk about kind of the history of the Jedi and the Mandalorians. So if you want more kind of more explanation than what I gave, this some good episodes to watch. And we also have the Clone Wars episode of Friend in Need, Season 4, Episode 14. And that's the first Bo-Katan appearance. So Bo-Katan obviously going to be heavily featured in Mandalorian Season 3. So if you want more on her and understanding who she is, I'd definitely check out that episode.
And you played by the same actress, too.
Yeah, voiced by the actress that plays her in live action. And this is where Bo-Katan and Ahsoka meet. So if you watch Mandalorian Season 2, where Bo-Katan kind of points Din in the direction of Ahsoka, it's kind of showing you how they met and how Bo-Katan even knows that Ahsoka exists. And then we have the Season 5, Episode 14, Eminence, Season 5, Episode 15, Shadow of Reason, and Season 5, Episode 16, The Lawless. Heavy Bo-Katan focus in these episodes, heavy Darksaber focus in these episodes, and these are another, like Tristan said, Obi-Wan centric episodes of the Clone Wars. Obi-Wan definitely has strong relations with some Mandalorians. Maybe a specific Mandalorian, but I won't get into that. I don't want to spoil it for anyone who maybe hasn't watched it and who's now intrigued to watch it. And also we have the Clone Wars episode, basically the final episodes of the Clone Wars, the final four episodes of The Mandalorian called The Siege of Mandalore arc. It's Old Friends Not Forgotten, Season 7, Episode 9, The Phantom Apprentice, which is Episode 10 of that season, Shattered, which is Episode 11, and then finally Victory and Death, which is Episode 12. This strong Ahsoka focus, obviously, I believe with Ahsoka is going to be the next live-action series after Mando, so I wouldn't be surprised if there's a few episodes that feature her this season, and we will also see kind of the budding and the formation of Ahsoka and Bo-Katan's friendship. So if we're watching season 3 of Mandalorian and you see Ahsoka and Bo-Katan hanging out and being friends and you wonder how that relationship potentially started, you watch these episodes and you get to see it for yourself. Any thoughts on the Clone Wars and Mandalorians?
I'm definitely going to rewatch some of those last half of the episodes you mentioned, especially like season 5, 6, 7, like those kind of start blurring together. for me, you know, so I'm going to have to go back and watch, especially like the last season of Clone Wars, season 7. I definitely got to get myself a recap on that, because people will mention that season as being not just the best season of Clone Wars, but some of the best Star Wars out there, you know? So I think if you have any interest in watching any of this, I'd recommend definitely checking out those later episodes of Clone Wars, because I think those are both going to tie heavily in, but are also kind of a peek of what the Clone Wars can be, animation quality-wise and action-wise and story-wise.
Yeah, for sure. And also, Clone Wars isn't the only Star Wars canon show to feature the Mandalorians. We also have Star Wars Rebels. We have Trials of the Darksaber, Season 3, Episode 15, and Legacy of Mandalore, Season 3, Episode 16. Sorry. This shows a lot of Jedi Mandalorian lore. I believe this kind of talks about the character of Tar Vizsla, the one who created the Darksaber. It shows the Mandalore, the planet of Mandalore, trying to get out from under Imperial rule. And some Mandalorians worked for the Empire, some hate the Empire, and some worked for the Empire reluctantly. So you get a little bit of maybe why certain Mandalorians in the Mandalorian are not exactly pro-Empire, and kind of what that reason would be. And then we get Season 4, Episode 1, and Season 4, Episode 2, which is Heroes of Mandalore, Part 1 and 2. It, you know, like I said before, it shows specifically why Mandalorians hate the Empire, like why the Mandalorians specifically. You know, obviously a lot of people in the Star Wars universe dislike the Empire, but it shows you get why Mandalorians would hate the Empire. And then we see kind of how Bo-Katan got the Darksaber before Moff Gideon took it. Moff Gideon references in Mandalorian how Bo-Katan had it, and he took it from her, and this kind of shows how Bo-Katan got the Darksaber. And then, obviously, if you want to catch up with Mandalorian Season 3, watch Mandalorian Season 1 and 2, as well as The Book of Boba Fett. And if you didn't know that, then I can't really help you much after that.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to watching these Rebels episodes, too, because I loved Rebels. It's my favorite part of Star Wars, but some of those Mandalorian arcs do kind of start to blur in. You talk about Tar Vizsla and the Jedi lore, and I say, I've seen these episodes, but I could not have told you most of that stuff you just told me, you know, so I got to get a recap, and I imagine that the Darksaber's lore specifically is going to tie pretty heavily into this season, because we saw it last season, and it's been pretty prominently featured around the marketing and that kind of stuff, so I definitely think I'm going to have to rewatch a couple of these episodes, and yeah, if you haven't watched any of this stuff, I definitely think follow Joe's watch order. It's all pretty good. Like, there's some great stuff in the Clone Wars and Rebels with some pretty bad stuff, but I think a watch order like this gives you a good starting point, because you're going to watch a lot of the highs, a lot of the really good stuff, and then you can go in and start filling in for characters you like and storylines you might want to see more of. So I definitely recommend it. I know a lot of people who only have watched the live action TV shows and have not given animation a chance for Star Wars, so I hope that this show, if anything, will inspire people to go back and watch all of this other stuff that I think is great and better than these live action shows have been.
So I've been doing some thinking, and I agree with everything you say. I definitely think you want to be caught up. Definitely check out those episodes. But as far as another character that could pop up, there's been rumors this character is going to pop up in another show. Any chance? I mean, this guy's already on the payroll. This actor already was the big reveal. Any chance the big reveal at either the finale or the premiere of season 3 of The Mandalorian is Captain Rex?
I think it's possible. I think that's a big reveal for Star Wars fans. Like, we'll all be hyped, but yeah. I think the general audience is going to be like, oh, it's another clone that's back? There's a clone is back? Okay, that's kind of cool, I guess. You know, I don't know if that's a Luke Skywalker level follow-up, but I mean,
it's hard to really top Luke Skywalker at that point. Like, he's the biggest character in all of Star Wars, like the most famous and prominent character, at least of the ones that are alive at that point. I guess you could argue Darth Vader, Yoda, and Obi-Wan, but they're all dead at this point. So, like, yeah, I think that's the biggest you could get is Leia. And then at that point, it's just like, you're doing it.
Yeah, once you've done the big three, it's like, what do you do next? You know, yeah. I think it does make sense when you have Luke Skywalker. Maybe you do tone it down. You bring it back to Captain Rex. You bring it back to somebody. Sure, the Star Wars fans would be like, oh, that's awesome. And the other fans would be like, oh, it's cool to see Tamara Morrison back in another role. You know, he's playing a clone trooper this time. That's cool.
So I have one question for you before we move on, and that is more of a thought of how the whole Mandalorian is going to end. To go back to my theory that Grogu is the titular Mandalorian and not Din Djarin, and I believe not this season, because Jon Favreau, another piece of news, says he already has season 4 written. I guess there's a imminent writer strike and director strike, and I guess Disney and Jon Favreau wanted to have the script written in case the WGA goes on strike, that they can still film the season because they have the script written. And also, Jon Favreau is going to be on set most of the time, so I feel like you can have a bare-bones script written and they can kind of change things around, move things around once they're on set. But that's neither here nor there. My question is, you know, Grogu's whole thing is he has the Force, but he's very emotional and deals with his emotions and has anger problems. If someone attacks his father, he basically rages out, and like we saw him choke Cara Dune. And so my theory is you win the Darksaber in combat. So what are the odds, maybe season 5 finale, season 6 finale, maybe even just the season 4 finale, someone, maybe it's a character we know, maybe it's a Bo-Katan, maybe it's a new character that we see, kills Din Djarin for the Darksaber, and Grogu, who's older, more mature, maybe he has a growth spurt, maybe there's like 2 or 3 years between season 3 and season 4, or season 4 and season 5, and he's now like this young adult, he's gone, he ages in a way differently than humans, he has his growth spurt. And he has to basically keep his emotions in check to defeat the person that killed his father, in a way to avenge his father, but also do it in a way that's mercifully, and also, but also not get so over emotional that he loses. And so Grogu avenges his father, Din Djarin, and now he is the wielder of the Darksaber, and this is kind of the end of the tale of the Mandalorian. And Grogu has the Darksaber, and he's now going to lead Mandalorian.
I think it's interesting. I like your theory that you talked about a lot, that Grogu is the Mandalorian, right? And this is about Grogu discovering himself as a Mandalorian and the Mandalorians accepting someone who's such an outsider. I think that's a definitely direction they can go. And I hope that this season gives us a good direction of what the plot of this really is, you know, because they talked about how these shows are going to be a Mandoverse, right? Like you said, there's going to be like an ending to this. What's it all building towards? And two, if not three seasons into this, if you're counting Book of Boba Fett as a season, I don't have a very good picture of like what the show is about, what they're really building towards, who even like the main villains are. Like Moff Gideon is a villain who's present, but they talked about Thrawn. I think, is he going to be like our main villain they're building up towards? Is it going to be Darth Vader? Like I don't get a lot of focus or a lot of narrative so far from this. So I'm hoping that this season gives us a bit more of that direction, because sure, it would be cool to see Din, you know, get killed a couple seasons later from now and Grogu take up the mantle and be, you know, go on like a vengeance quest, you know, but is that what they're building this whole universe toward? Is Grogu on a vengeance quest? I hope that they have something exciting planned for this season that at least gives us a sense of what they're building towards, because if they want these to feel like one unanimous long-running story, one long-running book, I want to know what I'm reading, you know. Or if you're just going to give us standalone stories, make them standalone stories, give us a Boba Fett season, give us an Ahsoka season, but that doesn't seem like what they're doing. So I want to know what they're going towards here. What is it all rolling up towards?
All right. So that, we only have one thing left, and I don't know what I'm going to do, because mainly because there wasn't enough content to intrigue my interest to get my vote. And so my thing is, do you have a nominee for MVP of the week?
MVP of the week, you know, I did not necessarily think about an MVP this week, but you know what, he protected his daughters, you know, he fought a lion, so I don't know, if you can fight a lion in the middle of the African wilderness, I feel like you gotta be the MVP of the hand plus. So Idris Elba, gonna go ahead and give you my handy here for this week.
Only problem with Idris Elba, if this was like an Amazon Prime original, I would be fine with that, but it's just a movie that got added to Amazon Prime, you know?
You're right.
So I feel like it's a little bit harder, taller of a task for me to sit here and say, this is my MVP of the week. I'm trying to think who out there could intrigue me enough, inspire me enough to give me their MVP of the week. I feel like, I mean, our big topic has been Mandalorian, but like no one specifically, like, do I say Jon Favreau for coming up with the Mandalorian as our MVP of the week?
They say Dave Filoni for telling majority of the story we talked about. You know, the whole Mandalorian history and all that is Dave Filoni's place.
I like that pick. We didn't really talk about it, but Bad Batch is coming out. Bad Batch has been strong. A lot of this, you know, a lot of what we talked about, Clone Wars, Rebels, everything that built up to this story to lead to the Mandalorian is somewhat the brainchild of Dave Filoni. So, you know what? I kind of like that pick. Dave Filoni is our MVP of the week. So
I like that.
So, yeah, Dave Filoni, kind of co-creator of the Clone Wars, co-creator of Rebels, co-creator of the Bad Batch, co-creator of the Mandalorian, is our MVP of the week of February 21st, 2023.
So, I have to imagine he'll get in there one or two more times over this year. You know, if he directs an episode of Boba Fett or of a Mandalorian, that's great, or something like that. You know,
and also I think he's directing all the episodes of Ahsoka. So,
well, I'll certainly get him in the list, I think.
Yeah. All right. Hopefully that show crushes. I think it will, based on the rumors and everything I've heard about it. Tristan, anything you want to say to the people before we wrap up?
I'm looking forward to next week. It's going to be a pretty stacked episode. Of course, we have the premiere of Mandalorian. We're going to be keeping up with the final arc here of The Last of Us. We're also going to be doing a discussion based off of Creed 3. We're going to do a discussion here of our top three trilogies that are streaming. So me and Joel will spend the next week watching a couple of our favorite trilogies, doing some research, figuring out what's streaming and what's not, and then coming back with each of our top threes of what we think are the best streaming trilogies. So if you're out there and you got some takes on what the best streaming trilogies are going to be, where can they hit us up, Joe? I know my Twitter is at @theworsttristan. Yours is at @_Joe underscore freaky. Where is our official handle at these days?
Yeah, if you want to tweet at both of us at the same time, message both of us, or send us a TikTok, I guess, at the same time, it's at @thehandplus on all three platforms. That's at @thehandplus, The Hand Plus. So if you want to message us a show, you think our take sucks, you don't want to ever hear us talk about Star Wars again, talk to The Hand at The Hand Plus. Before we sign off, Tristan, I got one final question. If we ever see an adult Grogu, who do you want to see voice Grogu?
Oh, God, an adult Grogu? We can't bring back Frank Oz, right? So I feel like the only way you got to do it, go the chopper route, Dave Filoni's got to come in. Filoni, he's got to voice this character. He brought this thing to life. If not Dave Filoni, let's get George Lucas in there. If you can give us some mumbles, you can give us some Grogu lines. That would be fun.
I was going to go with someone who was almost our MVP of the week, and that's Idris Elba as the voice of adult Grogu.
That'd be awesome. You get Knuckles in there, crossing over. I'd be down for that. Mark Hamill's done some voice work. You can get Mark Hamill in there doing some Grogu lines.
Yeah, I like that. Mark Hamill's a good option. Idris Elba. I'm trying to think someone just completely off the wall. Like Jason Statham as adult Grogu. Like, I want someone that's like kind of a crazy choice, like a dark, gritty, kind of violent voice. Idris Elba, Jason Statham,
Sylvester Stallone.
That'd be perfect. He's doing TV now. That would work. All right, I think that wraps up our show for this week. We'll be back next week, like Tristan said, talking about top three streaming trilogies. So without further ado, goodbye.